Before we start, if you could say your first and last name to make sure I pronounce it right, and give pronouns if you'd like to give pronouns, that would be great.
Hi, I'm Martin Paul Eve. My pronouns are he and him.
Hello, and welcome to Shelf Healing, UCL's bibliotherapy podcast. I'm your host, Rebecca Markwick. Our guest today is Professor Martin Paul Eve. Martin is a professor of literature, technology, and publishing, and the strategic lead for digital education at Birkbeck, University of London. Martin is also a visiting professor of digital humanities at Sheffield Hallam University. Martin specializes in contemporary American fiction, histories and philosophies of technology, and technological mutations in scholarly publishing. He does a lot of great work on open access and co-founded and runs the award-winning mega journal, The Open Library of Humanities. He's also written many books on literary criticism and open access, and his latest book, Where's the Infrastructure and Aesthetics of Piracy, will be published by Puckton Books this autumn 2021. The first question to get us started is nice and easy. Hopefully. Do you feel that reading is therapeutic?
If only that were an easy question. I think I'm wary of the instrumentalism of reducing reading to a phenomenon that could be deemed therapeutic, or the kind of arguments of value around empathy that we sometimes bring to reading, and the ways in which we seek to justify reading around a range of axes that really don't do justice to the full scope of what's involved. I mean, also the term therapeutic is one that needs a bit of unpacking there. So in some ways, yes, reading might be therapeutic if you've had a stroke, for instance. After I had a stroke, I read Tolstoy's War and Peace for the first time ever. Probably should have read it before then as a professor of literature, but I hadn't. And that was, you know, part of the recovery process there. But on the other hand, different people are going to mean different things by therapeutic in different contexts, whether that's psychological context or whether it's in physical illness context, could even be in the context, say, of grief. And what you read is going to affect whether or not you're going to say that's therapeutic or not. Now, I don't think many people would say that reading novels by Bret Easton Ellis in the midst of some personal tragedy, you know, is going to bring them great solace. I think also, one of the things I often say about literature degrees and what they do to your experience of reading is, you know, we'll wreck reading for you forever. There are ways of engaging with texts that are visceral, that are imaginative and fully engaged and almost bodily. And then there are more cerebral ways of engaging with texts, the sort of critical approach that we try to teach in university literary programs. And the way that you approach a text is going to affect your response to it. There's a great difference between reading a page turner for fun versus reading a work of high literary fiction and thinking about it critically, and both could have therapeutic angles, but I'm wary of just saying as a block, yes, reading is therapeutic or otherwise, and I'm sure all your guests have probably complicated things in that way.
That's why I think it's a good one to start off with, because it's interesting how people come at that question. I think we've had some very stark definite yeses, and then quite a few, that's a very tricky question, and then pull it to pieces, which I personally think is an excellent way to tackle that sort of question. And like you mentioned, you're a professor of literature. You have a brilliant crossover of literature and computing. Do you find that the digital enhances, or perhaps has the potential to enhance, the effects of literature?
So again, I'll go going back to the therapeutic angle here. One of the things that people don't often realize about computational work on literary studies is that the majority of the work is immensely tedious and repetitious and consists of cleaning up data sets of bags of words. So, you know, making sure that your transcription hasn't missed something, checking that, you know, this looks sane, it looks as you'd expect, so that when you do the work, it actually comes out right. Now, some people would say there's a kind of therapeutic effect in performing menial, repetitive tasks. On the other hand, it can be extremely tedious and doesn't feel like a worthwhile activity. It's nothing like reading a book for the first time and enjoying it. It's like going through a spreadsheet for a whole day at a time. Another example is that my work on David Mitchell's Cloud Atlas necessitated retyping the novel because there was not a digital copy available.
Was there not?
No. So you can get a digital copy, but you can't take the DRM off it legally.
DRM.
So it's there, but it would be a criminal offence to remove it. So to get a copy, the options were scan it and correct the OCR or retype it. And retyping a novel is quite boring, but it's also quite a good way of engaging closely with the text in ways you wouldn't otherwise. So again, swings and roundabouts that digital approaches can bring you closer to text, but it often does so by methods that are pretty destructive to your well-being in many ways. But on the other hand, the results you can get from that type of work are interesting and new and, you know, worthwhile engaging in. So I feel conflicted on how the computational approach interacts with therapeutic ideas about reading.
Yeah, interesting. I like what you say. The programming aspect and the computational aspects are frequently tedious. But then at the end, you know, you press your run button, it's all compiled and it's beautiful, and then it all just spits everything out at you and it's wonderful. That's got to be quite satisfying.
Yeah, if only it were quite that easy. Usually what happens is you find you've been running a thing for 3 days while it's trying to find a result, and then you realize there's a bug in your code and it's never going to work.
Your forward slash is on the wrong line.
Yeah, I think also people imagine there are sort of these eureka moments, but actually much of digital literary studies is about confirming or disproving previous literary critical assertions. And if you merely manage to re-show what someone else has done, then you're told your work doesn't matter. And, you know, we knew that already, even if you've come up with a new empirical way of showing that this is the case. It's when you find something that contradicts the critical consensus that's more interesting, but often those findings are quite small. So a really frequent assertion is that the most frequent words in the novel of Thomas Pynchon are back, for instance. Or Thomas Schaub has some assertion about the word frequency in Pynchon's novels. And you can quite clearly show this isn't the case, and that what he's actually looking at is foregrounding and the literary terms that have leapt out at him when reading. And that doesn't mean they're not significant, those terms, because they have been contextualized and come to the reader's perception, but it's a different assertion to saying empirically this is the most frequently used word in a novel. And that kind of thing is very easy to challenge and think about, but it's not a particularly exciting finding to say, well, sorry critic, you're actually wrong about the most frequent word in this novel.
Is there a particular book that has profoundly affected you, either over your life, a specific point in time, during your career, anything in particular?
Well, I'd say that there are two novels that have affected me in very different ways that I think I can split along those axes that I spoke of earlier, the kind of cerebral versus more visceral. My wife would probably agree that the novel I've ever most been obsessed about, to go back to something I just mentioned, is Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow. This is a rabbit warren of a novel. People become obsessed with it, and I certainly did. And, well, I wrote an undergraduate dissertation on Pynchon, a master's dissertation on Pynchon, a PhD on Pynchon, and a book on Pynchon. As a result, it's fair to say that affected my life quite profoundly. I probably wouldn't have become an academic had I not become so interested in that text. On the other hand, I think David Grossman's novel See Under Love from the 1980s is the novel that I keep thinking I should reread every year or two. I've read it several times now, but I think I will go back to it again. It's a strange, very strange, both in form and content, magical realist post-Holocaust novel, where the final chapter is an encyclopedia, and the narrative is presented in alphabetical order rather than in the order of the events they occurred, and the previous chapters only make sense when the encyclopedic portion fits together. And what's interesting about that is that when you describe that literary form, it sounds, oh God, here we go, clever, you know, literary text playing with you, but it's actually a deeply affecting text. It's really, you know, the pathos of what it achieves actually works really well, rather than just feeling you're being complicit in a game with the author. I don't know, there's something profound about that novel. I think it's one of the best I've ever read.
Yeah, very good choices. I like that. You're very open about illness, disability, and the role of literature and open access materials. Have you found that reading and open access has helped you during phases of illness?
I should clarify that there's a distinction in the realms we're talking about here, that, and yeah, we've been talking about literary production, publication, reception so far in the fiction publishing space. The other area I work in is scholarly communications and thinking about scientific research, humanistic research, about human histories, cultures, art forms, and the different access statuses that are possible to those works in the digital age. So the main point to emphasize is that the economic conditions of production for these two types of work are very different to one another. Academics are paid a salary to produce research work. You can quibble about that because lots of academics are precariously employed, temporarily employed, and so on. And most academics work on their research outside their paid hours. But nonetheless, the idea is that academics should be freed from market constraints. What we don't want is academics having to sell 5,000 copies of their book, because then we'd never investigate niche areas of research. You know, the scientific papers that are investigating, you know, routine basic science, not major breakthroughs and advances, but that are crucial. If everyone had to cater to make their salary by the number of copies of their papers they could sell, the scientific endeavor wouldn't work. But this means that academic production is uniquely well suited to openly accessible dissemination. If researchers don't require a market to make their living, then they could give the work away and people could read it for free, and that would be better for education in the digital age. So that's very different to fiction publishing, where we do not have such a system, although authors like China Mieville have proposed state-funded systems to subsidize fiction production and then would be able to give it away. Also, various fan fiction and so on, those cultures do have a culture of disseminating work for free. But that all comes back to, you know, how has open access affected me during my own periods of disability and illness? Well, the main way I've seen that is when it hasn't been there to help and affect what I'm doing. So in 2016, I had a stroke, and it was due to an incredibly rare combination of conditions. And I don't know whether you know this, but when you're in hospital and seriously ill, unfortunately, the diagnoses they give you change on a day-by-day basis as new information becomes available, as they change their minds, as different consultants come in. And it's incredibly confusing, especially if you're not in a great mental state in the first place. And so, I was doing my best to try and find out more about the various conditions to make sure that people were aware of the secondary literature around these things, and to make sure I could have informed conversations with my consultants. I was stuck in a hospital bed, obviously, and I was asleep most of the time anyway. But when I was awake, trying to do this research, it's incredibly frustrating when you hit obscure articles that very few people are going to be interested in. And it's saying, well, you can pay £60 to have access to this article for 24 hours. Like, I'm not paying 60 quid for some article I don't know about and whether it's going to be worthwhile or not. And it's only tangentially related, but it would be nice to read it. And I just thought, this is such a mess. You know, the people who did this research did it because they want to help patients, to help people in that kind of condition. And I wasn't really helped by it at all because I couldn't myself read it. Now, could my consultants read it is another question. They only have access through the hospital that I was in. Hospital budgets are not great for access to research literature. So, you know, it made me start to doubt the whole edifice of this endeavor and thinking, you know, is this really the soundest way for research to be communicated and published? And are we really helping patients have informed conversations with clinicians? And are clinicians really informed about the backgrounds to complex, multi-layered cases? So that's quite a long answer to there, but that's where I came to on the illness and open access front.
Yeah. It's important, though, because I think a lot of people who have an illness or disability are often in a position where open access would make their understanding of their illness or their ability to access information about it significantly improved. But like you say, a lot of it is very, very expensive in order to access certain things, which again doesn't really do much for people's well-being if you are ill, like you say, in a hospital bed, wanting to know more about what's wrong with you and coming up constantly against, here, £60 for 24 hours access. You want to pay that, don't you?
I mean, I think there are challenges because one of the most frequent arguments that has bounced back is, well, people won't understand this literature, so they don't need access to it. And I'm sure clinicians are frustrated by patients who've done a bit of Googling and come to them and saying, here's what I've got, and there is a kind of undermining of expertise in a way if that's the angle you're taking. But, you know, on the other hand, 50% of the population at the moment goes to university every year. as they come through. People are capable of reading higher level material often. And I just think there's a kind of patronizing attitude towards patients in this situation. And it doesn't make for a great informed clinical encounter. So, you know, while I'm wary of it, I don't think hoarding information away from people so they can't raise it as a question is really the way to go. I think it should be the starting point. They say, I found this article that explores the history of vascular degeneration in cerebral vasculitis cases. Do you know about it or whether it might affect my condition? You know, that's the kind of opening that I think would be a better way of proceeding. You know, and they can say, yes, I know this paper, but it's been superseded by X, Y, and Z, etc. It would just make for a better dialogue, I think.
Mm. It kind of brings me on to my next question, which is, what kinds of books do you go to when you're having a bad day and you want to improve your mental well-being? Do you go for the magical realism, magical fantasy? Do you go for academic stuff? Do you go for sort of comic books, graphic novels? Whereabouts do you go in the wide world of written word?
If I'm having a bad day, I tend not to go to reading, actually. I'd find it very difficult to concentrate to read something and get stuck into it. I tend to go to my own writing, actually, change that. I find the process of research and writing, I find that therapeutic, and I try to do it every day because it puts me in such a better mental frame of mind. And that does involve reading. So, perhaps I'm lying there when I say that, but generally speaking, I'd start by trying to write a paragraph and then realize the flaws in it and think, now I need to do some reading to work out, you know, what's wrong with this? Has it been improving? And that sets you down a rabbit warren of pursuing a chain of argument. So I guess I turn to research, reading, and secondary criticism and historical work when I need to get myself back in the right frame of mind. It also feels like you've done something, which I find, you know, often one of the things that frustrates me is, you know, if you have a day of 6.5 hours of Zoom calls in this pandemic period, often, you know, where's the work that I'm actually supposed to do around these calls? That writing is a way of calming myself, thinking, actually, look, you've produced something, it's fine, it's good, and it was enjoyable, and you found out something new. So that's where I turn.
Brilliant. So do you find that the therapeuticness of writing is different to the therapeuticness of reading? Or do you feel like they kind of hit the same little therapeutic button? Tricky question, I'm sorry.
It's fine. Yeah, no, it depends why I'm reading and what for. And the problem with much fiction reading for me is that it's part of my work. So it's not really possible, I find, anymore to sit down with a book and just enjoy it for the story. I've always, in the back of my mind, got questions about composition, form, you know, where it might fit in a canon. What, you know, is this thing that might be taught at some point? How can I link it into my research work? So, I don't find that reading really has the same effect it might have when I was 7 years old and, you know, me and my friend were reading Lord of the Rings together and we'd come in every day and discuss the last chapter and how much we'd enjoyed it. You know, that just that affective response to fiction. Writing, there's something about reformulating what you found and shaping it into a new form that is somehow enjoyable to me. And it's not the same as just reading about things. I mean, I never in my research process just read something without ever writing something about it because I know I'll lose it. And I also think that research forces you to read for a specific purpose. So that might seem hypocritical given that I opened with a blast against utilitarian reading practices, but basically, well, a good example of this, I must have read Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents many more times than I ever wanted to. And I always think, you know, right, this is the last time I'm going to have to read this and I'm going to make notes that are generically applicable that I can reuse in any context. And it's just not true because you teach it in a seminar and it's in a different set of texts for that day. You teach it, you use it in a research project and suddenly it's in a different context again. And I always find that research makes you take an angle on something and try to read it for a specific purpose. You're trying to find something out. So in a way, that re-perspectivization is an interesting way of reading that I enjoy, and that gives a structure to reading that otherwise might be formless.
Mm, I like that. That's very good, Martin. As a literature professor, do you find the close reading and literary criticism affects how you've said this a little bit already, how you can engage therapeutically with books? Do you find yourself able to pull the literary professor out of you and go back to that 7-year-old at all? Or like with a specific genre of books, maybe? Or is that little literary professor always sitting on your shoulder talking at you as you're reading?
No, I think my reading has been permanently wrecked. For instance, my wife is an avid crime fiction reader. Really, you know, new book arrived yesterday by Leslie Thompson, and it's almost read as far as I can tell already. I've read some crime fiction over the years, but my most recent project, I wanted to know, you know, in crime fiction, what are examples of of person voicing? You know, these things written in the first person, in the third person, past tense, present tense, what does it look like? And those are the kind of things that I've become attuned to even in reading genre fiction. So science fiction, for instance, I really like reading science fiction, and it's hugely enjoyable. Lots of my colleagues, though, specialize in working on science fiction. I know what kinds of conversation I'll have with them about it, you know, where it sits in the canon. I was thinking of Tade Thompson's Rosewater trilogy recently, which is this strange sort of alien spore type work. But, you know, instantly I'm thinking, well, this comes in the Wyndham tradition of the Triffids and a kind of biological alienism that's part of that. So I think, you know, and I should also say that lay readers who are not in the academy can also read in this way and develop their own complex understandings of canons. It's not unique to academia, and we shouldn't try to claim it in that way. But I think part of what we're trying to do with academic criticism is train people to look at fiction as a mediating form. And, you know, it's the same with television studies and film studies, that they have a real challenge in that when people generally approach these artworks, they try to see them as though they are direct mimetic representations of things. I think film is even worse than books in this sense. What we're trying to do is say, well, what's the mediating effect that made you think this is a transparent representation? Because actually creating something that it appears so real is done through extreme artifice and formal manipulation. And it's trying to foreground the things there so that people, when they read, when they watch films, see how things are put together to create the effect that they would previously have thought was transparent. And it's that kind of attention to that layering that I think is what literary criticism and close reading does. And close reading, really the best close readings, change forever how you will see a text, and you can't go back and read them differently afterwards, because that's now the dominant way that you think about a novel or a film. So yeah, it's powerful, but it does also change. It's a bit like the Matrix's red and blue pill. You know, once you've started this, it's quite hard to go back.
Yeah. You do a lot of work promoting open access. The OLH is fabulous and does huge amounts of groundbreaking work on open access. And there are authors like Cory Doctorow who really tried to push sort of the open access in the fiction world, because he believes, I think as many people do, the effects of sort of the piracy that comes out of that is so minimal that it's worth it. And then you get more people reading your books. What is it that you think, and obviously you've just written your new book that's coming out later this year, all about, I just love the title. It's so fantastic. Aesthetic piracy. I love it. What is it about open access that you hope helps people the most as readers or authors, as opposed to being a negative idea that people are bashing on?
Well, I mean, it's probably worth just explaining why people have negative reactions to open access. And one of the reasons is that publishing is not a free activity. It has labor costs in particular. And these are particularly high in academic publishing spaces, where we're talking about a small number of sales, usually of an academic book, for instance, with high production values, peer review processes, coordination, production into XML and PDF, et cetera, and final print. And the way that publishers have come up with, for the most part, to subsidize this operation, if they were going to give a copy away for free to download, is to say, okay, instead of lots of readers paying a relatively small amount for a copy, although it's not that small in academic publishing, but you take my point, let's ask the author to pay one single enormous amount so that we can give it away. And most authors in, say, the humanities disciplines just do not have recourse to funding to cover those publishing costs. And so what it looks like then is a two-tier system is emerging where people are being asked to pay to publish and they can't find the money and they fear they're going to be excluded from speaking. And they think it'd be better to exclude readers from reading rather than excluding them from speaking. But there are other ways you can fund this. And that's primarily what we've shown at the Open Library of Humanities. We persuaded over 300 libraries to pay us a subscription every year, even though we give everything away for free. Because libraries are the ones who've been saying, wouldn't it be better if the world had access to this knowledge? The other thing that often comes through, though, here is that people in the humanities say, well, I can understand open access to scientific research and medical research. You know, you made a good cause around that. But why is it really necessary in the humanities? And this just annoys me so much. It's like saying our disciplines don't matter. And people seem not to understand that the world is coming where every piece of scientific knowledge is available to anyone to read for free on the internet, while every piece of humanistic knowledge is going to be in a £60 or more book that the general public can't see. And these are supposed to be disciplines that are dealing with people, their art forms, their cultures, their histories. It seems to me bizarre to think there isn't an audience for this, or that it's a good idea that it's hidden away and that the impact of what we do will only be available to those who pay. So that's why I think it's important and why I have many frustrations around it. There are logistical barriers still to overcome, but if we don't try, then we're never going to get there.
Definitely. I mean, I think it's particularly interesting when you look at the journals. Like you say, there's a very strong divide between sciences, of course, open access, and the humanities. It's much harder to get people to agree to try open access for their monographs on, I don't know, some interesting fact about Nietzsche or something. Well, I think people would read it. If people were able to read it for free, I'm sure people would read an awful lot of the humanities research and books and journal articles that were out there. But it does seem like an uphill battle that you are going for very well, I must say.
I guess so. I mean, there have been other objections to open access in the humanities as well. I mean, some people just think, I want my work to be sold, which I can't understand personally, but there we go. Others feel concerned about open licensing and the impact that will have on people repurposing their work in ways they don't appreciate. The traditional straw man argument here is, oh, well, neo-Nazis will take my historical work and twist it. I'm sorry to tell people that neo-Nazis are not great respects of copyright in the first place, but it's actually libel law that you want if they have claimed that you've said something that you haven't. So, you know, there's a lot of tricky legal complexity around it. People have also conflated in their mind the idea of open access with some kind of uncontrolled, non-quality controlled mode of publication. That's definitely not the case. But I've now have 6 of my 7 published books available open access. The next 2 are also going to be open access. So I think, you know, I've pretty comprehensively demonstrated that these things work and they're not of any lower quality than anything else, but we're still a long way from that being a universally held norm.
Yeah. Is there a particular book or any area, can be fiction, nonfiction, anything you like, that you would recommend to someone who maybe wants to improve their sense of well-being or just wants to read something therapeutically or just wants to engage more with reading?
The most interesting, well, I've got 2 books that I think are really interesting that I've read recently that are both digital humanities books about approaches to literature, but both of which tell a story about literary evolution that I think is worth knowing. The first is Ted Underwood's Distant Horizons from a couple of years ago now with Chicago. This book opens with a kind of startling paragraph that says, this is a book about recent discoveries in literary history. That may seem surprising because most of the things we think of in literary studies are not discoveries. We tend to think of them as knowing the contours of history and we fit new arguments into those. But it's about saying, actually, we've read this wrong. The periodization is not correct. There are 200-year spans for the emergence of some genres like science fiction that are linguistically coherent over that period. It's a really interesting book. And it's not full of complex statistics that make you think, I'm just in a computer science class here. It tells a story about literature using data. The second is Richard Jean Soh's Redlining Culture, History of Racial Inequality in Contemporary Fiction, which is a book that looks at statistics from the publishing industry over the last 50 years and the racial demographics of people who are published. Polemical at times. One of the lines in this book is, Random House does not publish black authors.
Shots fired.
Shots fired indeed. But, you know, it's a really interesting text. It also examines specifically the role of Toni Morrison in her role as commissioning editor. So the thing that people perhaps will not like so much about that book is that it says the problem is that the academy, in focusing on a diverse curriculum, has masked a problem in the publishing industry. And that our attempt to rebalance things has not actually resulted in change on the ground in publishing. We've just made it look like a diverse canon actually exists. But again, you know, I think this is an exciting work for bringing a data-driven approach to thinking about this and then saying, what are we going to do about it? Yeah, therapeutic or not, those are interesting books.
Yeah, but then who's to say interesting isn't therapeutic? We've had a couple of academics come on who say when they want therapeutic reading, they want to be very, very challenged by what they read so they can engage mentally, which I think is quite a nice sort of, similar to your, you know, where you want to write what you've been reading. I think that's lovely.
I hope it was Random House, but I haven't just made a serious allegation there. I'm just thinking back. There's a little while since I read it. I apologize to Random House if it's not you who was targeted in that book.
A publisher
is what I'm afraid of it. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Martin.
Thank you.
Another of those very, very interesting, thoughtful interviews there with Martin Paul Eve. Thanks, as always, to Nicholas Patrick for our music. We'll be back next week with another episode of Shelf Healing. Please do check us out on Twitter @shelf_healing and give us a review, if you feel like it, on your podcast player of choice.